Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast set entirely on a space station. Today we are going to talk about all sorts of things, from Zelda spoilers to the new game Prey. First, we'll start off with some news, including Mass Effect Andromeda and the future of that franchise, an 11-year-old getting GTA and finding a big bag of meth instead, and a whole lot of Ubisoft leaks on Assassin's Creed, Far Cry, and more. Then we'll bring on Editor-in-Chief Stephen Totillo to talk about Zelda, and we'll wrap things off with Kirk and I talking about our initial spoiler-free thoughts on Prey. Let's go! We are back for another episode. My name is Jason Schreier. I am news editor at the video game website Kotaku.com. I am joined by Kirk Hamilton, the editor at large. Hello, Kirk.
Hey, Jason. How are you doing?
You feeling at large today?
I am so at large. Absolutely gorgeous in Portland this week. So I've been super at large out in the lovely weather, riding my bike around and loving life.
Just being at large.
Being at large.
Portland, Portlander at large, Kirk Hamilton. Yep. So we have a lot to talk about today. We have a Zelda spoiler cast to get to. And
very exciting.
We are both going to talk about Prey.
Also exciting.
But before we get to the news, you were playing something else you wanted to talk about, right?
Yeah, well, just very briefly, and I'm going to have an article about this, I guess, on Kotaku tomorrow. I've been playing Minecraft on the Nintendo Switch, which is really good on the Switch. It's kind of hard to talk about Minecraft now, you know what I mean? Like, because Minecraft
is just Minecraft.
Yeah, it's just Minecraft. Which is sort of this funny statement, because Minecraft is still an amazing game, I think. Like, it's still, to say, oh, it's just Minecraft, but yeah, it's just one of the best games of the last, you know, ever. But it is still Minecraft, and you do, like, I start, and I still do the same thing, and I dig a hole in the side of a, you know, of a mountain, and I start to build my house, and then I get into that sort of Minecrafty zone. But man, it is, the Switch version is very good, I think.
What makes it special on the Switch, other than the fact that it's portable?
I mean, that's what makes it special for me. First of all, it's just good. It's a good port. I mean, it runs 60 frames per second. It looks really good. It, I gather the world size is bigger than the Wii U version. It looks great in handheld and on the screen. You can play split screen with people, which is cool. I haven't done a lot of that. You can play multiplayer, which there's no voice chat built in.
Can you play split screen with people while listening to split screen?
I would imagine that you can. You can't. I'm probably not listening to split screen on your Switch, because the Switch does not yet have a podcast app.
Yeah, that's
a shame. One of the many software things.
We should talk to Nintendo about getting an exclusive.
We're available on such podcast apps as Panoply, the Nintendo Switch podcast app, Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, exactly.
Leave us a review on the eShop if you like our podcast.
Exactly. That would be incredible.
So it's cool, though. It's really, it's cool. And you could get together with your friends, which I haven't done this yet, but you could, you know, if you and I both have Minecraft, we can get together and play. You could come into my Minecraft world just while we're hanging out, you know, at PAX or something.
Uh-huh.
And just, I could show you around and show you the thing that I made using our Switches, which is really cool. The portable aspect of it, I think, is cooler than I was expecting anyways, just because there is no great portable version of Minecraft. The Vita version is like fine, but it doesn't run that well.
A lot of people play it on iPad.
I know a lot of people, like, and kids really like it on iPad, which makes sense because the interface is the thing about the Switch version that's kind of, you know, there's so many different menus and you're kind of almost using a mouse cursor with the thumbsticks. It doesn't, like, it works, but there's a lot going on just because Minecraft's a complicated game. And I could see that, you know, the touchscreen version is easier, especially for kids. But the fundamental controls of, you know, the first person sort of thumbstick controls work. And so this is the best portable version I've played by far.
And can you play the split screen with each player holding a joystick? Does it work like that?
You can't, which is sort of a bummer.
Okay.
It would be pretty cool if you could just have like, you know, I don't know how you just, there's no way you could. There aren't enough buttons on like half a Joy-Con to do that, even though it would be really neat to
or
to
a full
that.
Joy-Con, not half a Joy-Con, because each one is a Joy-Con.
Oh, yes, right. The uncombined, right, just one Joy-Con, not right. two Joy-Con.
The non-Voltron versions of the Joy-Cons.
Right, the individual tigers or whatever they are.
Tigers, Voltron. Yes, the individual
robot tigers. Yeah, so you can't do that, which is I guess, too bad. It would be cool, but I don't hold it against it. Anyways, I've been having fun playing Minecraft again. I'm getting killed by zombies and building big buildings and stuff, so that's
very cool. Well, so I've been playing a lot of Prey, but we'll get to that. And I've also been playing Nier Automata. I got ending A, which is cool.
Yes, I think we're around the same place now too. I also got ending A and I'm midway through to get ending B,
so maybe one day when we both finish we'll do a spoiler cast at some point in the future.
Yeah, I think that'd be fun.
Cool. All right, let's get to the news.
Let's do it.
It is exciting. We're like 4 weeks away from E3. Did you realize that?
I realized that yesterday when you and I were talking about E3 podcast stuff, actually, which we're, you know, I don't know what quite yet we were saying. We need to kind of figure out the specifics of our, we have a broad idea, but the specifics of our scheduling. And then I thought about it and, oh, it's in kind of like 3 weeks or something. E3 is happening much sooner than I had anticipated, which is pretty cool.
It's exciting. It should be a fun week. I'm looking forward, for the podcast, we're going to do some cool stuff that I think if you enjoyed our GDC podcast coverage, which if you did not listen to, you should go back and listen to, because we did some awesome episodes from there.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And had some cool guests. But yeah, if you enjoyed that guest-heavy split screen, you will really enjoy our E3 coverage as well. Mm-hmm. All right, let's jump into the news. So first of all, hot off the presses, some Kotaku scoops. Mass Effect Andromeda was bad news for EA. They were unhappy with the critical reception to the point where they turned BioWare Montreal, which is the studio behind Andromeda, into a support studio by moving a bunch of their people to EA Motive, which is the studio headed up by Jade Raymond. So a bunch of people from Montreal went there, and then some people are staying to do support on Andromeda patches, and then Dylan, which is BioWare's new IP that they're probably going to announce at E3. And so Mass Effect is on hiatus for a while. I doubt that they'll kill it, like, for good. I mean, I'm sure at some point we'll see another Mass Effect game, but as of right now, there is no successor to Andromeda in the plans for BioWare, according to my sources. What do you make of that, Kirk?
Let's see.
Are you sad to have no more Mass Effect?
No. I mean, like you said, I don't think this actually means no more Mass Effect ever. Even though if it did, if we never got another Mass Effect game, that would be fine. I mean, You'd be fine with that. I'd be fine with that, sure. I mean, I think there was enough Mass Effect already. Like, I like Mass Effect, and I liked those first three games. I didn't really like Andromeda very much. I don't need more Mass Effect in my life. I feel like I got enough, and there are just so many new interesting things coming out all the time that I don't require us to be making more Mass Effect games forever. Uh-huh. However, I don't think that's the case. I think they would be that EA would be crazy to never make another Mass Effect game. So at some point we'll probably get one. Fine. I think it makes sense, right? Like, it seems like I'm not surprised by the news, even though it's a bummer for everyone who worked on the game. But
the other undercurrent here is that EA, and they talked about this a lot in their earnings call earlier this week, they are big on live service games. That's where all the money is, right? So, like, if you look at all the biggest games of the past few years, it's Destiny and The Division and Ghost Recon Wildlands is one of the bigger games, and For Honor and stuff like that. EA's own FIFA is a live service game. A live service game is basically code for like a game that is constantly updated, which is usually an online only game like an MMO or an online shooter like The Division or something like that.
Well, and it's telling that by moving people to EA Motive, they're moving them to be working on Battlefront 2, which is going to be a live service game, like the multiplayer of that game anyway.
Yes. Yeah. And also the other half of the studio, the people who are remaining at BioWare Montreal, are working on Dylan, which is also a live service. That Dylan is the code name for their new IP, which is also a live service game. And word is, it's a lot like Destiny. So we'll see if I win that prediction. We'll see when they announce it.
It's interesting to watch EA. I feel like for some reason EA's publisher strategies are more transparent to us than some other publishers, or at least people talk about them more. I just watched this a really cool short series by Mark Brown, the Game Maker's Toolkit guy on YouTube. He did a three-part series on Dead Space, which, you know, tells the story of Dead Space. And it's interesting because Dead Space itself, those three games very clearly articulate the changing priorities that EA kind of set for the games. Like, the first one was, okay, we're going to try new things and this will be this weird horror game. And the second one was, okay, we need this one to sell more, so we're going to make it more of an action game. Uh-huh. And then the third one was, oh boy, we really need this to sell more. We're going to make it into a straight up Uncharted game. And you can, it's interesting because EA is sort of in the background of the entire conversation in a way that Activision isn't necessarily in the background for conversations about Call of Duty or Destiny or whatever. And so I feel like now we're again seeing EA maybe making another shift in, you know, in another direction and doing this live service game. And having watched that, just watched that and thought back to, man, that period in 2008 when EA put out Mirror's Edge and they put out Dead Space, and there was this sort of, that was this whole other EA and the various strategies they've tried since then.
Two thoughts. First of all, I wouldn't say that Activision isn't in the background for a lot of this stuff. I mean, I'm sure Activision...
Oh, I'm saying, I mean, of our conversations. It's not, we're not usually as talking as specifically about what Activision wants from Call of Duty.
Sure. I guess. I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll see, because it feels like a lot of their... Well, I don't know. I don't know how those decisions are made. But the other thing I was going to say is I feel like Mass Effect Andromeda's development, I think a lot of people blame EA for the problems that that game has. But I think, I mean, I don't know. More will likely be revealed in the near to mid future. And I think that I don't think it's squarely on the publisher. And I think people like to, as much as I don't want to be defending game publishers because they can do some terrible things, I think that oftentimes when a game has problems, it's for a lot of reasons, not just because the big bad evil publisher is trying to pressure them. And Mass Effect Andromeda was in development for about 5 years, which means that EA gave them 5 years of funding, which is more than most publishers.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was something that came up in some of our conversations at GDC with developers too, is that there's an easy narrative of, oh, the big bad publisher ruined everything, but rarely is that the entirety.
Exactly. Rarely is that the full story. All right. Next news story.
Yes.
Let's see. Okay. This is a funny story by Mike Fahey. 11-year-old gets a used copy of GTA 5 from his mom, and his mom finds a little baggie, and it is a bag of meth, and he brings it to his mom, and his mom calls the cops and freaks out. Oh my God, imagine. I mean, first of all, it's hilarious that she's okay with buying her 11-year-old GTA 5.
I do like that that's the way the story begins, which I feel like, didn't we do a story? Someone did, or we thought about it, talking to, like, there were all these kids talking about how they get their parents to get them GTA.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, like when it came out, it was such a thing that little kids would want it, and they'd try to find these ways of circumventing the rules. So this is such a, it's such a like cartoonish like cautionary tale, right?
Yeah, and I would also say at 11, I feel like whatever, you can handle GTA.
Sure,
well,
sure.
Maybe it should be a little.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, it depends on the 11-year-old. But
right.
But it's funny to just say, oh, and if you get it, it'll literally have meth in it. Like, it's the thing of, you know, it'll rot your brain. Well, okay, this had meth in it. Also, I like that this happened in Florida, because of course this happened in Florida.
Uh-huh.
If you had told me this happened, I would have said Florida, right?
Yep.
And then the answer, yes, Florida.
So everyone listening should go find Fahey's story on Kotaku, because it's a great story, and he got the police report everything.
Man, it just, yeah, he has the police report here, which is, you know, bears the whole thing out. It really happened. One thing that was interesting about this, I think, and as much as we're laughing, I think it would be really scary
to
buy your kid, the mom is really, you know, legitimately freaked out, thinking, my God, like, my younger daughter could have gotten into this and found it, and who knows what could have happened. And that is, that is scary. And I thought it was interesting that people didn't believe her because this exact thing happened once before. And they're like, oh, you stole that. She was, I think, writing about it on Facebook, and people were like, oh, you stole this story. It didn't really happen, because this already happened once. And, you know, GameStop's comment is sort of, you know, we work really hard to keep this kind of thing from happening, but it apparently happens. And
I don't know if they check every single copy of every, I mean, I guess you have to open
you kind
up
of have
copy
to
if
you,
you
should at least
GameStop.
Notice a baggie of drugs, like, yeah, sitting in the thing. I feel like you could probably notice that.
I'm just saying, like a tiny little bag. It's not like you're a minimum wage making GameStop employee. It's not like
sure.
It's not impossible to imagine someone missing.
Well,
that.
Clearly not, because it happened, and it wasn't like malicious. I don't think. I'm sure it just slipped under the radar. I liked the related stories under Fahey's story. One is man finds ecstasy in used copy of Grand Theft Auto. Very similar story. The next one is boy opens Christmas PlayStation 4, finds a block of wood with a dick on it. Do you remember this story? It was that someone, I'm going to open it up and like, I can't remember whether it was a prank on the kid or whether he
block of wood with a dick on it.
And it does, it's amazing. It's just this, it's like a PS4 shaped block of wood. Oh,
yeah,
and
I mean, I'm remembering this.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. That he wrote from cock and balls with love. On the thing, which is so dick. On the Facebook post, apparently the mom said, "This has ruined his belief in Santa." Which I'm laughing, but it's so terrible. Okay, so that was one. And then the third one is man buys PlayStation 4 from Walmart, says he got two bags of rocks. And it's just a picture of a PS4 box with two bags of rocks in it. So these stories are all pretty entertaining. I think, are they all Fahey stories? Man, Fahey is all over the like weird things packaged in with games beat, which is a very entertaining beat.
That and Snacktaku.
Anyway, right. Nice that nothing bad happened to this kid.
Next story. So with Ubisoft, with E3 coming, Ubisoft is, as always, leaking everywhere. And so there have been a few notable leaks over the past few months. One was the Mario Rabbids RPG, which we talked about and had been rumored for a while. It's coming to Switch later this year. Another one is Assassin's Creed Empire, which is reportedly called Origins, according to the internet scuttlebutt on Eurogamer and other websites. And there was also an image, I don't know if you saw it, of Assassin's Creed Origins that had leaked out and is floating around the internet.
I think just just in my RSS feed or something. What was it of?
Yeah, we haven't reported on any of this stuff. Steven might be working on something. I'm not sure. It's not really that. I mean, we already knew because I had reported back in January 2016 that it was set in Egypt. So we already knew that. The only newsworthy thing is the title, which whatever, we'll see it.
And so when you say it's Empire and Origins, Empire is the internal name and Origins is what people are saying is the actual name.
Actual title, yes.
Origins, really?
We needed another game with Origins in this.
They couldn't have called it Assassin's Creed Rising.
Well, it'll be fun because we can do a compilation or even rank all of the games that are
called Origins.
Origins, yeah. From Arkham Origins to Assassin's Creed.
My main takeaway from that, and I didn't really follow it very closely, was that I think I'm ready for another Assassin's Creed game.
I'm so smart of them to skip a year.
Yeah, that's all I really like.
But one more leak. Is Far Cry. So there's also another Far Cry game coming this year. And so this was actually a crazy set of circumstances that led to this leak, and it's partially my fault. So on NeoGAF the other day, someone posted that a link to a news article from like a Montana website saying that they had been talking to someone who was filming a live action trailer for a video game in this town in Montana. And they said that it's a video game set in Montana. And so NeoGAF was speculating that this is Red Dead Redemption 2. And then I posted in the GAF thread because I wanted to kind of cut down the speculation. And I was like, hey, guys, Rockstar doesn't really do live action trailers. And actually, this sounds like another game that I've heard is set in Montana. And then people
You just wait in there just to keep people from speculating.
And people immediately guessed Far Cry. And then I made the mistake of saying good guesses. And then that immediately led to like 40 different random gaming websites posting that Jason Schreier says the new Far Cry is set in Montana, blah, blah, blah. But then what people did, and this is where the internet reporting machine turns into just a disaster, is they, in all of their reports, they linked this to a survey that Ubisoft had sent out in 2015 asking if people would like to see a Far Cry game in 19th century Wild Western Montana. And so they put two and two together, or really put five and seven together, and assumed that because one thing was true, the other thing must be true also. So then you see on like all these garbage websites, like I think even some big websites like VG247, which kind of has this reputation for just running anything that is sent to them, are running these articles that are like, rumor, Far Cry set in the Wild West. And so I had to tweet about this and just like talked about this a little bit, is like, I haven't actually heard anything about it being set in the Wild West. All I've heard, and I heard this ages ago, was that the new Far Cry is going to be set in Montana. And I think Far Cry games are always in modern times, so I imagine it'll be modern Montana.
Well, I mean, always, except for the one that's set in caveman times, but yeah.
Oh, that's true. Well, mainline Far Cry games.
Yeah,
and this is supposed to be Far Cry 5.
Right, to look at Primal as kind of an offshoot.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That kind of ruins my theory. But yeah. I don't think it's a Western game. I think it's like an interesting modern Montana game where you're dealing with like militia and stuff like that.
I think it's fun to mention that Ubisoft mentioned a Wild West Montana Far Cry in like some questionnaire, like purely as an unrelated thing. Like Ubisoft puts a lot of interesting things in those kinds of questionnaires. I think Steven wrote about this once for Assassin's Creed. Mm-hmm. And you never know. I mean, there are times where I'm not sure about this actually. So this might not be right, but I believe there have been times where Ubisoft games have come out and you can look back and find them asking about it. Oh, I think it was like a pirate game.
I think there was
a survey or like a user survey where they were like, how would you feel about a pirate game? And then they came out with a pirate game. I might be misremembering that.
No, anyways, you're right.
Those Ubisoft surveys are kind of fun because they have all this crazy spitballing. And you start to think, well, maybe they'll really do that.
So, the problem was just like the way that people reported it was like linking these two things that really have nothing to do with one another.
And then this is what the rumor is.
And this is such an interesting thing about how the sausage gets made, is that the NeoGAF thread happened and then one random YouTuber linked that to the survey, and then tons and tons of websites, mostly websites that no one has ever heard of, just like random game websites with game in their names. But if you Google news, like Far Cry, Wild West, you'll find a ton of these, and they're just putting all these different parts together and creating these rumors. But yeah, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure it's set in Montana and it's modern setting, not a Wild West setting, just to clear the air. But anyway, so the point is Ubisoft is leaking, as always, ahead of
E3. You think we'll probably hear about this stuff officially in a couple weeks, like at E3?
If not at E3, then before. If not before E3, then at
E3. It seems like E3 would be a good place to kind of be like, the new Assassin's Creed and the new Far Cry, like those would be the kind of two big things. Or maybe Far Cry would be their, you know, they always do like a stinger at the end of their press conference.
They do have one other game that I know about that I kind of mentioned on Twitter last year because I thought they were going to show it last year.
People really need to follow you closely if they want to get all the rumors. You need to get the little subtle NeoGAF follow-up responses from Jason Schreier if you really want all the information.
That's like when we talked about Shadow of War before the predictions.
You're a hard guy to pin down sometimes.
Kotaku Split Screen, your place for video game hints, clues, tiny clues. No, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'll report some of the stuff. We'll see. But yeah, I don't know. Ubisoft should be interesting, and we'll talk about all that stuff as more leaks and as more comes out. I'm sure there will be tons more leaks because everything leaks from retail, if not from other random places.
Yeah, well, we'll see if this year Microsoft's entire press conference leaks again.
Oh my God, that was unbelievable. I still can't believe that happened.
Yeah, we'll see.
Like just the fact that someone was tweeting their entire schedule was just unimaginable. It was just hard to believe. Speaking of that, I heard they might have a disappointing show, but I guess we'll see. All right, so I think that's it. What are we talking about? We're going to do our Zelda spoiler cast, and then after that, we are going to talk about Prey. So first, let's bring on Steven Totillo to spoil the hell out of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Steven Totillo is the editor-in-chief of Kotaku, and he is joining us today to talk about The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Before we get started, I should warn everybody that we are going to spoil the hell out of this game, so if you have not finished it, You just leave the show right now. Just turn off your recording. Just go.
Never
away.
Actually unsubscribe from Split Screen. Just don't come back ever. You're
stop
done.
Stop listening forever. Hello, Steven. Welcome to the show.
Hey guys. I'm glad we can finally talk about the part where you can play as Zelda. Nobody has been talking about that.
We were also excited about it.
I hope everybody found that.
we can finally talk about that.
Yeah, it was really cool that they did that.
So, Steven, you were telling us that you were actually texting us frantically because you beat Calamity Ganon last night for the first time.
Yes. So I've been playing the game since a little bit before it launched because, like you guys, I think like both of you, I had a Nintendo code like in late February. Mm-hmm. And I've been playing it on and off. As I mentioned, on like every podcast appearance I go on, I had kids recently and that's affected my playtime. But the Switch has been great. And I've been able to play Zelda mostly in portable mode. Anytime I play it on my TV, I'm shocked at how like big scale it looks, which I mentioned on the show in the past. Mm-hmm. So to give a slight dramatic rereading of text messages, 9:47 p.m. last night, text to Jason and Kirk, trying to beat Calamity Ganon for the podcast and getting my ass handed to me. Is he invincible when he's glowing? Kirk didn't bother to help. Jason
so
immediately
responded. I was busy. I think I was watching TV, so I tuned into this conversation when it was all nice and resolved, which was really a relief for me.
Jason
was mostly helpful to you.
Jason responds, yeah, use counterattacks or reflect his lasers. And I say, can't skip these cutscenes, arg. Because as you guys know, well, did you guys fight Calamity Ganon having beat or gotten control of the four divine beasts?
Yes.
Or did you do fewer
I did,
than four?
Yes.
Okay, so we all have had the same experience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's like a ton of cutscenes. They're cool cutscenes, but I couldn't skip them. Jason says you
could skip
the plus
everyone
button.
Because I fought him like 10, 15 times, and this is before the game came out, so I couldn't look up strategies or anything.
Right.
And I skipped the cutscenes every time.
You couldn't text people and hope
that I only exactly. fought him once because I just kicked his ass. But well, that's you... also because I was pretty OP by the time I got there. I had like an absurd number of hearts and like the best armor in the game.
Jason, how many shrines in were you?
I don't know how, probably 20 or
did
something.
Did you have a second row of hearts?
No. No. I was relying on food. And,
okay, what'd you go in with?
Well, so my battle was actually really epic because so I got all four divine beasts, but because I was reviewing the game, I had to be playing pretty hastily.
Right.
So I didn't take my time and explore. I had a couple
of regions.
You
wrote about this recently. That ruined your rushes.
Yeah,
but rushing,
how it ruins everything. Although they gave us a fair enough time with the game.
They gave us a week, and because
no, it was like a week and a half.
And you and Kirk were going to GDC,
and
you were
able
to
play on the plane.
Yeah, I think the challenge was more that you were going to be traveling for the last 4 days before the embargo lifted than that we didn't have enough time.
It was bad timing. But anyway, so I got there, and I actually skipped all of Hyrule Castle by jumping up the waterfalls.
Which is too bad, because Hyrule Castle is really cool. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a moment.
I'll come back one day. But so I got there and I had all this
food. So, Jason,
food.
What were you wearing?
In the game? Or?
Yes, in the game.
In real life.
I was wearing, I think, the champion's gear that you get from Impa. The blue tunic and the stuff that Impa gives you.
Impa gives you more than just the tunic?
No, just the tunic.
The tunic. That's what I'm talking about.
I thought you were saying there's a whole ensemble.
No,
there's
no.
not like a champion.
I had been under the impression that there was.
Wait, hold
sort
on.
Of
I have to finish my
wasn't.
Story. You guys keep it
down. Finish your story.
So I get to Ganon, and I have like a single row of health. I'm running out of food, and it took me 10 tries, but eventually the way I beat him was this epic journey where I couldn't figure out how to counter it. Like, I didn't realize that I had to counterattack to beat him while he was invincible. So I would just run up to him and mash the attack button, and like, I found ways to do damage to him. I think if I used arrows at the exact right time, and it just took me forever.
You can use Urbosa's Fury as well. That was actually what I figured out, because I broke like four shields trying to counter him because I'd never really learned how to do it. And you can charge up Urbosa's Fury and it knocks him on his back and makes him vulnerable.
That was helpful. The end, I was like completely out of food. It was epic.
So you were eating for attack power or just health?
Everything. By the end, I was eating anything I could. Like, I was eating raw apples in my inventory.
Don't you like the idea of Link is in this throwdown battle with the ultimate evil, and he's just like horking down like food that he's prepared, just omelets and apples,
just
and just like
down.
Pausing in the middle of a fight to just eat and eat, and he's so full, he's like burping and fighting.
So unless I missed it, they don't actually put a fast travel point, or like a shrine or anything, right before the encounter, which is a little bit unusual because, you know, this game breaks a lot of Zelda conventions, and one of the conventions that it seemed to break at the end is that usually if you clear a dungeon in a traditional Zelda game, or at least if you've solved almost all the dungeon and then gotten the big key to open the door to fight the boss, you've usually then created some sort of pathway that allows you to quickly go from the entrance of the dungeon to that boss encounter. And in some cases, like Majora's Mask, they do that because you eventually have to speed run the whole game, you know, in the 24-hour cycle or the 72-hour cycle or whatever. But in this one, I was standing, like, you know, I'd failed, and then I restarted it, and or it restarted me, and then I'm standing right outside, and I realized I didn't have a lot of hearts. I didn't have a lot of cooked recipes, and I thought I could go away to a shrine and, you know, warp away and cook stuff, but then I'd have to climb all the way back there, and I didn't want to do that. So I just took a cold, hard look at what my inventory was. I realized I had 45 spicy peppers, and I could just, like, power eat them if I needed to in order
just
to fill
Link
up my...
Link is eating peppers and crying.
Yeah. Like those reviewers, those hot pepper reviewers. Yeah.
So at 9:47, I guess I was saying, he was kicking my ass. And I'm happy to report that at 10:01 p.m., 14 minutes later, I text, got him, I think. Jason writes, nice.
Yeah, because I didn't want to spoil.
Also at 10:01, I write, oh, no. And at 10:02, I write, fuck, with four U's. And Jason writes back, ha, 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 don't worry. And then at 8 minutes later, I triumphantly report, got him with the glow bow.
So the reason I said don't worry is because I knew exactly what you were up to, and I realized that I know that if you die to Pig Ganon, you just start at the beginning of Pig Ganon rather than at the
though
beginning
also
of
if
Calamity.
You die to Pig Ganon, I mean,
you
did
died
you,
to Pig Ganon. Yeah, Jason,
did
you died
either
of
you
died?
Because I feel like
yeah,
it's almost impossible
because
to screw
you
that
get,
up.
If you get caught in his face energy beam, that kills you in one hit. At least it did for me.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, I felt like that part was just a gimme coda where they're just saying, have fun. Here's an awesome bow that never runs out of super magic arrows.
Well, wow. You know what? Some of us are trying to review the game by
you know,
deadline.
It's also, I didn't actually love, I thought the ending was really dramatic, that final scene, that final fight against whatever he's called, Ultimate Ganon. But I didn't love how Zelda tells you exactly what to do. It felt very different than the rest of the game. This is actually my sort of one of my criticisms of the ending sequence. Yeah. Like, she says to you, she's basically saying, like, doing that Zelda thing where they say, here's what you're supposed to do, here's how to solve the puzzle, go up and do that, that the older games did, that the newer, that this one didn't. And it sort of bugged me. I was like, okay, Zelda, I know, shoot the glowing spots on him, shut up, I get it. And she just kept telling me what to do.
The final encounter is very dramatic, the both of the Ganon fights, but for all that the game deviated from Zelda formula, they did not deviate at the end. And I think they just didn't know how to end the game. And a lot of open world games have this issue in that they can be sprawling and you can explore open world games in lots of interesting ways. But with the exception of maybe Red Dead Redemption, I can't think of many open world games that could do something as ingenious with their ending as they did with some of the stuff that they put within the game. And here, I mean, I knew instinctively that the ending wasn't going to take long, the ending sequence, because I thought this game is designed really for you to just pile up enough statistical improvement so that you can fight this guy. So they're allowing you, essentially the whole game is a very big menu of ways to get lots of hearts and which are you going to order up and do. And then once you do it, they just need to give you a fight so that the credits can roll. But they clearly didn't have anything super innovative. And I don't know that I would have wanted them to because I don't know that I want to have that be some ordeal that any time I want to sort of, I don't know, punctuate the game again, I would have to go through some long process.
Mm-hmm. I think I agree. And I think the way that the game is structured overall is really smart because specifically the way that they did that, the way that they said, okay, the whole game is wide open and just the structure of this game is there's this one big fight and the entire point of the game is to get ready to fight it. And really that's the story of Breath of the Wild, right? There's like these two parallel stories. And the main story is just Link went and dug up a bunch of shrines and got more powerful until he went and beat Ganon. And
it's sort
then
of the
there's...
Same,
oh, go ahead.
It's sort of the same plot as Mass Effect 2, right? The whole game is about setting up for
just
that ultimate fight.
And,
I don't think
you
can
and
kind
actually,
of sequence jump,
it's sort of the same plot as Horizon Zero Dawn, which, you know, I don't want to spoil you on, Steven, but that's one of the many similarities between these two games is that there are kind of these two parallel storylines because, you know, the other part of what I was saying is that I think Breath of the Wild has the second story that's told through the flashbacks that you find that is this sort of the thing that already happened that you're then able to just watch these cutscenes sort of unfold. I'm curious, Steven, what did you think of that story?
I thought the memories were terrific. I'm not usually a fan of cutscenes. I was initially skeptical. I was skeptical of a lot of things in the Zelda game because I've so loved the traditional Zelda formula. And
you didn't
really
like it at first.
At very first, I liked it. I liked the plateau, which is what I initially previewed when I think Nintendo first let us write about the final copy. Just like the plateau or the first few hours or whatever. And so I wrote positively about the plateau because it had that nice mix of being open-ended, but I still sense some structure because they've locked you onto that landmass. But once I got off the plateau, the openness of it began to bother me some because I'm so used to the Zelda structure and I so trust and enjoy the way the Zelda games are usually unfolded as a series of puzzles for me to solve that have, sort of specific pathways through them that you sort of grok as you get items. And to know that, there's just 12 places I can go in the game world, and if I go to them, I'm pressing the play button on a cutscene, seemed like the most un-Zelda, challenge that you could have. And I'm not one who cares much about video game story. And yet, I really enjoyed the process of associating those images with places, of figuring out that the painter guy who, Kirk, as you pointed out on the site, is actually a bad painter. That he would always be around to tell you about a place near him. Uh-huh. I initially thought he was just going to randomly tell you about one, but then I realized, there are systems here. And the more I began to understand that there were systems hiding in this game, the more, I guess, showing what I look for in games, the more I could sense that structure, the more I found myself enjoying it because I saw, I can play within this structure. I can search out these scenes. And I enjoyed the story that they were telling. I enjoyed getting it a little bit of out of order because I didn't get the cutscenes, I think, in the exact order same. Of the memories.
I don't think I think it's supposed to be out of order.
Yeah.
There's no defined order.
Yeah, it actually wasn't until I went and I just looked, because, you have that log of them in your iPad.
Oh, yeah.
And I went and looked and I saw the order that they're in chronologically, and I hadn't totally assembled them that way in my head. And it was actually pretty cool. Yeah. Once I had them all to say, this is the order in which this played out. And it does tell a pretty coherent story when you put them all in a row, though you have to kind of connect the dots and fill in some blanks for yourself, which I liked.
I wound up caring more about the story in this game than I think I ever have for any other Zelda game.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated how subtly they told it through diaries that you would find in the world. I mean, Hyrule Castle is, in a way, for me, my experience with Hyrule Castle is a microcosm for my experience with the whole game, which is that I approached it with a lot of skepticism and a lot of lament about what it was not when I first found it, and then discovered the more that I explored it that, it's not the lock and key puzzle sequence, get a cool item thing that I so love about Zelda, but just trusting them and exploring it, I discovered there were so many hidden chambers and delightful twists to how that area is created. There are hidden rooms in there that have diaries from the king, from Zelda. They tell some of the backstory that you otherwise wouldn't find. And ultimately, this game is so true to Zelda's roots and its history in that it is about poking around and exploring. And the castle, like the rest of the game's amazing open world, is so rewarding if you just start poking at it. Even yesterday, I found the big rocky enemies. What are they called again? I'm forgetting.
Talos.
The giant
stone
ones?
Talos.
Yeah.
The Talos.
Yeah,
I found a stone Talos in the basement of the castle, and
really?
By far the hardest
castle.
I haven't
found that.
Have you found the minecarts in the castle?
Yeah, yeah. That's like one of the alternate ways in, right? Around to the side?
Yeah, there's two of them. And one of them leads, they both involve, there's Korok puzzles tied to each. There's lots of Koroks in the castle, which initially I couldn't find any, and then suddenly I was seeing them everywhere. And one of the minecarts leads to a stone Talos fight where the vulnerable spot is not on his head, which is where what I would usually do is I would do the freeze magic, and then I would climb him, and I'd stand on his head and just whack at the things growing out of him. But it was on his back, and it was really hard to figure out how to get to his back.
I've fought one of those before.
Yeah, and if you kill him, he drops a lot of gems, but the main thing that he drops is suddenly there's an updraft and allows you to shoot up to like two levels up in the castle.
Oh, that's cool.
But there's all these like great subtle quests that are tied to the castle and tied to the finale. There's one about finding a whole set of weaponry in Hyrule Castle that are like uber powerful weapons. And then I'm curious, what horse did you guys fight the final Ganon with?
I was riding on the royal horse, on Zelda's old horse, or the descendant of Zelda's horse.
So you did the quest where you got that, the white horse.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yes. Yeah.
No, I was just riding on a wild one that I had captured.
So I wonder if the game just picks your best horse, and if you get Zelda's horse, then...
Oh, that's a good question, because you don't... Or maybe the last horse that you equipped gets picked?
Could be. Either, I did I also have that as my last horse, but yeah. I only happened to do that quest like a day prior because I was like looking through my quest log and I'm like, what have I not done? Oh, maybe I'll go and see if I can capture this, tame whatever, this white horse. And then it was such an asset in that final fight because it has great stats all around.
Right,
and
right.
It just felt kind of fitting. I'm using
and right. Horse. It looks really cool. Which I mean,
That's why I died and you guys didn't because you had a better
you had
horse.
A bad horse
because you didn't have the horse.
I had one of those spotty horses.
So I want to ask you guys about something. So another way in which this Zelda breaks convention, and I think it is the first Zelda to do this, is that it has multiple endings.
I only know about one.
When I finished a game, I hadn't gotten all of the memories.
Okay.
And so when you finish a game without getting all the memories, Zelda says something like, do you remember? And then the game ends. And then I believe if you get all the memories, something else happens. Is that right?
Yeah, you get... I mean, it feels to me like I don't know if I would describe this game as having multiple endings, actually. I think I would say that this game
has one true ending and one
has an ending, and
ending.
Then there's sort of an incomplete ending that suggests to you that you're supposed to go get the real ending. Like, it isn't
right,
like,
but Zelda's never done that before.
I don't remember a different memory playing. Isn't it that you're with her and you're about to go back to the Zora place?
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
it sort of seems
scene,
like it's setting up DLC that, or something like
but
that.
But I'm saying that scene doesn't play. Like, it just ends with her saying, do you remember? And it's hinting at you. It's telling you should go find the memories, right?
So,
but
yes.
It's interesting because the Zelda game has never done that. Because this open world game, and you can tell because it's on your main quest log still, is to collect all the memories. And it's telling you that because it's a main quest, it's part of getting the proper ending.
And it's cool that they suggest to you that you should do that while leaving it open in this way. They've made the game into this like speedrunner's dream where you can just go fight the final boss if you want, and you can technically beat it, and then they still tell you, oh, you didn't do all of this. And so something I really liked, I really liked the story too. I've seen a lot of people now that there's a Japanese voice track complaining about the voice acting, but I actually think I thought it was fine, and I think the animating, like the animations are so good.
Yes.
Especially Zelda's animations. I feel like I know so much about her character.
And she makes a weird facial expression in the final scene.
I'm trying to remember.
She makes like a goofy grin to Link when they're like goo-goo eyeing at each other at the end. Sorry,
yeah, well, and there is I want to talk about that. I'll get to that in a second. So I liked her story in general. Like, I think that her frustration with her inability to sort of do what she was supposed to do, the way her dad was kind of a dick about it, and how she kind of resented Link because he seemed so... set in his destiny and stuff. Like, I thought that was all interesting and made her a more interesting character. And then reading her diary, and you find out the whole actual story of, what Link's actual deal was and how they came to be friends. And one thing that I thought was really cool, and Steven, you and I talked about this, I remember when you were not liking the side quests, you were saying something, the side quests in this game are pretty thin, a lot of them. And I sort of looked at them as they were pushing you to go different places and see different things and sort of fully piece together this really large, intricate world.
Right.
And so they had to be kind of simple on their own because they were part of this larger organism. And the story, to me, kind of felt that way, too, where you kind of had to piece the whole thing together and it didn't totally make sense until it did. And I thought that the way that they ended the story really tied that together well. So what happens at the end of this, once you've gotten all 12 memories, there's a 13th memory. And you go and you see, what's her name, in Kakariko Village, and she shows you this painting that's sort of the one last photo. Steven, you and I were talking a little bit about when you were looking, trying to find it, where it might be, and she says, oh, this is where your last stand happened. Like, you probably know this area by now. And I remember when I played, I did know the area because it's the scene of this huge battle, clearly, that happened between a bunch of Guardians and Link at Fort, down sort of east of those mountains you go through. And I just remember thinking, this is really cool that I've gotten to know this whole kingdom so well, that this final thing, like, I know what happened there. I know this is where it all went down. And then I went and I found the memory there, and it shows Zelda unlocking her powers. And I really thought that was a neat way to sort of involve me in the finale.
That is cool.
There are very few games that exploit the fact that when you play them for a long time, you absorb so much about their topography and their soundscape. And many games don't earn that earn your memories, earn you mm-hmm. knowing them that well. And Zelda, this game exposes some of the mundanity of the world design of, say, Far Cry 3, 4, Primal.
Yeah.
As much as I enjoyed those games, they lack memorable locations. I'm enjoying what I'm playing of Horizon Zero Dawn so far. I'm 25 hours in. And even though areas look different, I very seldom have a sense of place vis-a-vis where other places were. And Zelda, in a number of ways, including locking you just onto the plateau in the beginning and putting the castle in the center and eventually having the beasts all point red lasers at the castle, is very good at orienting you. But they also put a lot of really memorable locations in the game. And I just want to point out that the only other game I can think of that did as good a job of getting you to really of saying to you, the player, hey, I know you have absorbed this all and you can hear the sound effects in your head, of all things, is Banjo-Kazooie. Because at the end of Banjo-Kazooie, like the first of what are like three successive endings of escalating boss battleness, there's a game show that Gruntilda the Witch puts you on. And as you stand on different pieces of the board in the game show, it's like, do you know which of the things in this game made this sound effect? And they play a sound effect, and they have like three different faces of three different enemies in the game. Or then they have like zoomed in textures, and they say, do you know where this texture or this part of the game world was? And it was the only ever other time I saw a game basically saying, we know you have this all burned into your retina by this point. And I like that, Kirk, that Breath of the Wild did that for you, because it did for me in many ways as well.
Another game that does that actually is Dark Souls. And that's something that I think people reference Dark Souls a lot talking about Breath of the Wild. And that's one of the things for me anyways. There is that similarity where with Dark Souls, both you'll get to a high point and you look back and you'll see everywhere that you went, because they do sight lines very well. Like Nintendo, I think, does the best sight lines I've maybe ever seen in Breath of the Wild, but From does very well with that, with Dark Souls. And then also in Dark Souls, there will be these riddles or these mysteries that will give you two very cryptic lines referencing where the bell tolls or something like that, or you know, the crumbled cathedral. And you'll think, wait a minute, oh, there's that crumbled cathedral, because you go over everything so much. And I think, not to always be ringing the same bell, but because there's no map, and there's no, you know, in Zelda also, like, you don't, when you get to the top of a tower, you just see everywhere around you, and the sight lines are so clear, and you're always visually orienting yourself. You know where you are all the time, and you learn all the locations.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts, and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Because of that.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life 1 week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
I think that compared to other open world games, Zelda's biggest advantage is that, I mean, first of all, you can climb on anything, so there's no, it doesn't ever feel like there are barriers, which I think helps you figure out your spatial recognition and surroundings. But second of all, it feels like everything that you do is rewarding in some way, because there's always a shrine around the corner, or there's always a secret that will give you some interesting item that will help you out, as opposed to other open world games like Skyrim. That's the one I always use to as a point of comparison, is where it feels like there's the potential of rewards everywhere, but then you get there and it's like, oh, just another fucking Draugr dungeon or whatever, or like just another chest with some useless items in it.
I don't agree. I don't think the rewards in the game are that good, and it's part of what I had trouble with early on. I'm used to playing Zelda games where by finishing a dungeon, I get this cool grappling hook that lets me, you know, pull myself across, you know,
right,
a chasm.
You have to think of the rewards a little differently.
And
It's how you define a reward thing, right? I think is sort of what you're talking about here.
Right. So early on, I do the Zora area, and I'm beginning to get a little skeptical about the game, because I've gone from the plateau having a good time. I'm on my way to the Zora area. I did not like the climb to the Zora area. I thought it was kind of, it seemed just
Which way did you go? Did you just follow the road?
I went on the main path that the prince told me to take, and I was like, oh, it's just like they've just dropped a bunch of enemies in my way. This does not seem like the level of creativity
you
I expect
from these
people.
You didn't see the big text blocks, like those big shrine things?
A couple of them, but I didn't get them all. And then when I found the quest for that, I found the way they logged that quest to be probably the worst logged quest in the entire game, because they say you need to get 10 of these, not counting the one you're reading this text log off of, and you found 5. And there's like no way.
It doesn't tell you which ones.
And really, maybe they thought they were teaching you how to use the map and put markers down or something, but I didn't do that. And I actually have been meaning to go back to the Zora area now that I understand the game better 100 hours later, see if I appreciate it differently. But I don't remember why I was talking about the Zora area.
The rewards.
Area. The rewards. I went there and I was not – oh, and I got the Zora gear, the full Zora gear. And I guess the chest piece lets you swim up waterfalls. And I'm like, that's what I'm looking for. Maybe they'll have more of those things, more like items with cool abilities. But no.
Not quite.
Mostly, I then found, no, if you find 100 beetles like they're asking you to do a grasshoppers, you're going to get 100 rupees. And it took me a while to get over that, because it took me a very long time to recognize what Kirk was articulating before, that really the point of a lot of these quests isn't fundamentally for the reward you get, but for pushing you into new areas of the game to explore.
Let me clarify. When I'm talking about rewards, I'm not talking about side quest rewards, and I'm not even talking about items all that much, although I did find little endorphin thrills out of getting cool new weapons that I found and replacing my old ones, because the breaking weapons thing never really bothered me, but we can get into that later. For me, a reward is, hey, I went down this place that I would think that nobody would think to go down, and I found this giant monster. Oh, cool, the designer's name. Or like, hey, I went to this island that's in the corner of the map, and it turns out to be this entire survival minigame that's like this whole crazy thing, unlike anything else I played in the game. Or there's another labyrinth, or like I go to this other area, and it's a giant darkness zone, and you have to like feel your way around lighting torches.
I agree.
Those are rewards.
Okay, right. And that's what so I was struggling with the game. It's something I'm going to write a bit more on the site eventually, because I want to talk about sort of what I went in expecting and how I think this game may have been difficult for, if not others, at least for somebody like me who has a certain type of taste in Zelda. And it was sort of difficult to appreciate, but then so rewarding once I understood the game. But I eventually, early on, after becoming sort of disillusioned by, say, the Zora area and everything. So what I started doing after I was kind of just bummed out about the Zora area was I thought, okay, I'm just going to pick a spot on the map, like a section, and just explore it. So I chose the east side of the map. And I just started going up the east side of the map. And like, okay, then they have these, like, there's these islands that are just off the coast, and they're like these huge towering island little plateaus, and they're connected by bridges. And
yeah, they look like from Game of Thrones. They look like the
King's
Iron Islands
from Game of Thrones.
Fun fact, they're all named after Tingle or Tingle characters or something like that.
Well, one of them is Tingle Island, but spelled differently.
The others might be after Rosie Rupee Land.
Which was a good game.
Nice.
I imported that from
England. It never came to North America.
Translated into English. They released it in Europe, but never brought here. But you know, it would be one thing after another. I would explore the north of the map, and there would be the Goron Gym, and then there would be this huge skeleton, which at the time I didn't understand what the Leviathan skeletons were. And then I would go up like a path on the volcano, and it would lead to like a ruin, but in the ruin would be a good sword or something like that. And I discovered that, okay, the game is not going to give me the big clockwork kind of puzzle solving that I've liked from previous Zelda games. But it's going to do something that open world games have not done for me before, which is basically put something cool and interesting every possible place I can go. And so now I think it's the best open world environment that I've ever been in. And the thing is, do you guys want to restart the game? Because I don't know that I will have as much fun going to all these places that were partially amazing just because I was discovering them for the first time. I want to continue to explore and find more of the stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to restart the game. I've thought about this, and I actually stopped playing because I want to try it on the hard difficulty because I'm powerful enough now that I want to try fighting harder enemies and just see what that's about. But I want to, you know, I still have enough left to do. I have like 27 shrines and one labyrinth and, you know, I don't know how many Gorok seeds. And I feel like there's enough for me to do that I don't need to restart, because I'm with you. I wouldn't have the same joy doing this all over again that I, you know, even though the game is always fun, every time I start playing Zelda, I have fun just because it's endlessly interesting to play. But yeah, I don't necessarily.
So for me, it's Amanda has been playing, so I just watch her like discover all these things, and that's a cool experience also because she needs help a lot of the time because she's not used to so many video, because she doesn't play a lot of games, so she's not used to a lot of the video gamey aspects of it. Like last night, she was in the area where you have to sneak around the Gerudo, the thieves of the Gerudo from the Gerudo City.
Oh yeah,
and you're going to get that helmet, and so she was able after many tries to sneak past them and stab them all in the back and stuff, but she couldn't figure out what to do next. And it was only after me pointing out to her, like, oh yeah, there's a magnet wall that you would have no idea existed unless you somehow poked around or...
Right, and we're constantly thinking through all your variables and
right,
that
exactly.
kind of very gamer
right,
way.
Which is a video game thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's such a gamer thing to do, is like you think, oh, okay, what are my tools here? And I don't think if you don't play a lot of games, I don't think you're even used to taking that approach.
I mean, I even still have that happen sometimes in Zelda where I'll think, oh, right, I could totally use this, you know, this one, like the kinetic tool. Like, I just wouldn't want to use it for a while, so I just won't be in that mind space.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also a very Zelda thing, is every time you go into a new puzzle room in a traditional Zelda game, you're thinking, what are my objects? What are my options
here? Yeah.
And by the way, I would be very curious to see you guys give Zelda to your significant others and see what happened.
To see how it goes?
Yeah. Steven, have you ever tried giving it to your wife?
No, I don't. She's watched me play. She told me last night when I was playing, after I, you know, killed Ganon initially, she's like, I'm like, I think it's over. And she's like, it's not over. These games never end.
She's like, look, I know enough about these games that it's not
over.
She's
like, these games never end when you think they're going to end. Because often I'm in a position where I'm trying to finish a game before, you know, we were going to, you know, basically retire for the night. We've got these kids now, and we sort of try to keep things very regimented. And I'm like, I just need to get a little further for the podcast.
Right.
But if it doesn't work, I'll finish on the subway in the morning. And so instead, that's been weird, by the way. I've gotten to some of these dramatic Zelda memories. Like the cutscenes I've been playing while I'm on the subway surrounded by people, and you know, it's sort of like I'm not used to unlocking like major narrative rewards and like plot turning cutscenes or whatever. I don't know, in the middle, in public.
Right. Just Zelda is like crying in the rain and someone's just eating some like disgusting food right next to you really loudly.
Like, I hope I'm not spoiling it for this person. I hope this person isn't a big Zelda player.
That's a big concern.
So, Kirk, you were saying before that I was down on the side quests, and it's yet another thing that I've really warmed to in the game. Again, to bag on the Zora section, either I did not understand that section when I was there, or it is the weakest section. I think the Gerudo section is by far the best design section. Not necessarily that it's Divine Beast is the best, although I like the camel a lot, but there are a lot of really creative side quests in the Gerudo area, and I like that they have a reward dangled out there for you if you do all the side quests, which incentivize me. For those of you who are playing, I won't give everything away, but make sure you do the 7 heroines. It's really cool. Get the quest for the 8th heroine and do that one, because that's arguably as cool or better.
What is the 7 heroines?
You didn't do the 7 heroines.
No.
This is the spoiler.
Also, like,
cast,
so in different parts of the world, they cut heroine differently. So there's at least 7 heroines.
Yeah.
So you have to go and do all of them one right after the other, and Link gets really high.
And then you solve.
And that's how you beat Calamity Ganon.
Right, they give you the 8th heroine, and then you're really ready to fight Calamity Ganon.
Kirk, did you do the 7 heroines? Did you find
No, I haven't yet. I'm waiting.
Oh my,
I've got it.
Guys.
I did. Well, I went and did the one thing that you told me to do.
I don't even know what it is.
The thing that you tweeted vaguely.
You did the thing I told you to do.
The snowball thing.
Yeah,
but I never actually did. I got there and then I had run out of snowballs. So
all right, I'm giving the split screen listeners some tips.
Okay,
nice.
Find the 7 heroines and do the shrine quest related to that, because it's fun. It's basically statues that are in the Gerudo area, basically on the eastern edge of the desert.
You can kind of see them on the map. I think I know what you're talking about, even though I haven't been there.
You can sort of see them. Amazing how many things are actually been hiding in plain sight. There's
a
quest.
Yeah, man, totally.
there's a quest in the swamp area, and it's like, go to the mouth of the snake. And I'm like, where's the mouth of the snake? And I look at my map, and
yeah,
I'm
like, that one.
Wait a minute. Okay, we're doing all spoilers, right?
Yeah, of course.
The river is the shape of a snake, and the head of the river is an open mouth. So that's where it is. So I would tell people, do the 7 heroine quest. It's neat. Find the 8th heroine. You can get that prompted by the guy who's just outside of the Gerudo walls. I think everybody listening to this has found the dragon on the icy mountain in the east. That's another must-do.
Oh, yeah.
Try to find either of the bowling quests. I think there's only two of them, but the bowling quests that are shrine quests in the northwest in the snowy area. The one I tweeted about a long time ago is good. I don't check my Twitter feed and go back a few weeks for when I say, everybody go here, and I point to a spot on the map. I think those are some of my highlights of where I would tell people to go.
Do you guys
have
one
highlight? Yeah, I think that's a good... Well, so we have to wrap things up.
I want to say one more highlight.
Kirk, I'm going to ask everyone to say their favorite.
Ask first, and then I'll say my highlight.
Well, I have to structure. We got to have some...
No, it's true. Stephen likes
structure.
Just like
Stephen with his kids, we have to have a regimented schedule here.
Yes.
So, Kirk,
okay,
why don't you go first, since you're very eager to talk about your highlight?
So I wrote about this on Kotaku, and Stephen, you and I talked about it when we were talking about side quests and them coming together. But the whole thing with Kaas, the Rito, the accordion playing Rito,
yes,
who you
so
find
good.
All around the world singing songs that each one, almost all of them, lead to a shrine. One kind of randomly is just a treasure, like a side quest, and it doesn't lead to a shrine. But there are all these songs that he sings about the world. And then he's also standing at stables a lot, playing Epona's theme that's sort of mixed in with the new stable anthem, which is really cool. And he's just this really kind of great character. I really like him. He seems like a really nice guy. And then if you really explore and you kind of find his journal at this sort of place he's staying that lists all of the places he's found and the songs that he's learned about them, which then lets you make a checklist, which is what I did. And I had a couple left that I hadn't found. And like, you find them on your map and you go find him and he's there. And then if you do all of them, it dovetails with this quest that takes place at the Rito village, where his kids are all there, and you don't actually realize they're his kids, or I didn't anyway. And they do this whole singing recital, and it's a whole separate shrine quest. And it's a really cool quest with music, and then they're all back at the village singing afterward. And then once you've done all of his things, you come back to the village, and he's there as well, and he's like playing accordion with his kids, and they're all playing the music, which is the what's the island dragon that thing from Wind Waker?
Yeah.
And they're playing this beautiful, beautiful music together. And I just
thought
that whole thing, and then he plays you a song and he tells you this extra story about Zelda. And like that kind of, that's the kind of reward that to me is the thing this game does best. And I really loved that a lot and just thought it was really cool. So that is my highlight.
Steven, what's your highlight?
And for those of you who haven't done all of that, I can't remember off the top of my head the name of the place where the journal is. But it is in the western area of the map, below Rito Village.
It has a good name. Wait, I'm gonna find it.
It's on top of this weird mushroom looking thing. So wherever there were the weird mushroom looking things.
I think that has a specific name, like Mushroom Forest or Mushroom Area.
It's Washa's Bluff is the
Washa's
name of
Bluff.
The closest area on the map that's named. That's where you can find him, which is a good name.
Yeah. So Steven, go there, get the journal, and then do all the things he mentions in the journal, because there are some really fun shrine quests
associated with that.
Yeah, actually, the thing that disappoints me about shrine quests is every time I find a shrine, I want to be doing puzzles, and then I get there and there are no puzzles because it's at the end of a reward.
Yeah, the beginning, I used to think, oh, sweet, I get the reward. And then toward the end, now I'm kind of like, no, I want to do a shrine. I don't need more hearts. I want more puzzles.
Exactly. So, Steven, what's your favorite part of the game?
It might be the thing I tweeted about, just the amount of surprise, the cool thing that you find when you go to that spot.
And what's that for people who haven't checked your Twitter account?
Well, I mean, I people could enjoy like just checking my Twitter feed and finding the spot on the map.
The beginning of the quest starts on Twitter. It starts on Steven's Twitter account.
It's one of those ARGs.
But it's partially the context of how I found it, where I just decided, okay, I'm going to explore the snowy northwest area. There was the character who tries to have you do like surfing challenges and stuff like that with the shield, which I didn't like. And then I found one of the quests that involves bowling a snowball down what essentially are a bunch of different lanes, and you have to get them to go down the right lane, the proper lane, to knock open a door that gets you to a shrine. And then there's another variation on that where you can't get a smooth lane without solving a little micro puzzle. And when you knock down the door, there's not just a shrine in there, but a massive skeleton of a creature.
Yeah, it's
and,
super cool.
They don't expect something that significant. I told somebody else who I've been DMing a lot about, and we've basically been exchanging theories about the game, and did you go here, did you go there? And this guy had been trying to do the Leviathan Bone Quest, and I told him to go there, and I didn't tell him what he was going to find, and he writes back to me, OMFG, I've been trying to find the final Leviathan all this time, and it was at the end of that thing. So he was very excited. So I would say that... just the overall Gerudo experience of doing all that stuff down there was probably my favorite stuff in the game.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of mine. I think mine might have been the Dark Island where you just have to navigate. Yeah. Did you guys do that? Where you just have to navigate, like, using torches and...
A forest.
Well, it's like...
It's like an island of darkness. I think it might be surrounded by water. Yeah.
Because you actually, it's one of the few places. It's sort of like the Lost Forest in that you can't get into it from random directions. You have to go through one entrance that it funnels you into. Otherwise, it teleports you back. And then you go in and it's just super dark and you have to like navigate your way around. And the reason I enjoyed it so much is because when you get to the end, there's this giant ogre and...
Enox, yes.
And he has the orb that you need to solve the puzzle on his chest. Mm-hmm. And if you're very sneaky, you can climb onto him, grab the orb, and then go to the chest, go to the place where you need to put it without actually attacking him or fighting him.
Yeah.
So that was a cool moment.
I know you guys are the masters of ceremonies and you had your own structure. But if I may hijack, I would like us to end by each saying our strategy for defeating a guardian.
Okay.
Oh, man. Okay.
Mine is run away.
Run away. freeze, stasis, whatever that power is, and then run up and just whack him with, while wearing the barbarian armor, and whack him with my best sword.
Man, okay. That's not, so my strategy is, I wish I'd thought to freeze them, but I don't, or the last time I played, I didn't. And instead, I have all the guardian armor, so I put that on. And I have usually like a triple or quintuple bow with the guardian arrows if I need it. That I can use on them like as backup, but I just try to use the master sword on them. But then I actually a lot of times wind up in the situation where you're trying to hit their legs, because if I can get one leg knocked down and knock it over, then it's game over and I can just wail on it until it's dead. But a lot of times I can't, and then it's like skittering away from you and you're constantly trying to get to it, and then it's lasering you and you know, knocking Link onto the ground, and you wind up, and it doesn't do that much damage because I'm wearing the guardian armor, but my strategy is not as good as yours, Steven, so I might start
wait you guys
yours
don't
instead.
Just reflect the laser beam.
No,
I'm not good enough with the reflection. The game never trains you. I want to point this out. I'm sorry. I know we're so into overtime, but here's one of the coolest things about the game. I'm exploring Death Mountain, which has a disappointingly small number of cool side things. I actually felt like that, even though Death Mountain is really very impressively visually designed, it doesn't have, I think, as much interesting stuff to explore and find. But they do have this one thing where I had read, possibly on Kotaku, I don't remember, that if you throw rusted weapons at a certain kind of Octorok or whatever it is, it'll inhale it, and then it'll spit it out polished. And I'm like, how did anybody ever find this out? Well, sure enough, if you're in the Death Mountain area and you get to the northeast of the mountain, you're near a body of water, and there is an Octorok or whatever, again, they're called. I don't remember if they're Octoroks in this game. And he's on like a little island, and you kind of can't reach him because it's like, I don't know, maybe even like deadly lava around him or something. But there's then two torches on the coast right nearby, and there's rusty weapons sitting right there. And the game is basically baiting you to pick up these rusty weapons and throw them at him. And so I don't know if the person who found out this whole deal about how he spits out on rusty weapons discovered it here, but I thought it was so cool that the game is essentially giving you a tutorial hidden like in the complete armpit nether region, whatever, of the game to know how this secret works. And like, who knows where else they've just sort of handcrafted tiny little tutorials for some of the secret
mechanics.
Yeah,
I still wonder if there are things in the game that nobody's discovered yet, like giant secrets. Because oftentimes when are there Zelda games that have like big secrets? I mean, I guess there are a couple. I'm trying to think if there are any games where it's just taken a long time. I guess Destiny is the closest, but that was
Where they do something like Fez, where like there's codes hidden in the soundtrack that people discover a year later or whatever.
Yeah, but this is a perfect example of a game that would have something that's just so obscure and buried, and the game's so big that people might not find it until
months. And even if it isn't there, they still have the opportunity to add it. which is kind of a tantalizing thought.
It could be put in the summer stuff, and then mm-hmm. it could be put in the DLC, the dungeon DLC. Who knows? We could get a traditional Zelda dungeon with the DLC this fall, which I think would be incredibly cool.
I'm really curious for $20 in an expansion how much they're actually going to deliver. And one argument would be that's a third of the price of the game, so you could expect as much as a third more of the game added.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Like, you know, something as huge as that. But on the other hand, $20 doesn't seem that much for expansion pass content. And I know some people are grumbling about what they're releasing in the first wave, but that is like a couple of new modes and a Cave of Trials or whatever, a Tower of Trials, whatever it is, and a couple of other things. I could see them almost being able to rhetorically get away with, we're just adding another dungeon the same size as the others and like three quests around it.
I feel like this game should have been $80 to begin with, so I'm not really, I don't really have a problem with paying
$20 about should, but maybe could.
Definitely could have. I don't know. This is a whole other argument that we don't have time to get into now, but I've always felt like game prices should be able to fluctuate. Anyway,
cool.
Steven, thank you so much for being here. Yeah. Zelda Breath of the Wild is obviously an incredible game, and we all enjoyed it quite a bit. That's why we spoiled the hell out of it. Steven, goodbye.
Goodbye. Till the next time.
I could talk about Zelda forever, just for another hour.
One day
I feel like
talk about
the
forever.
Only other thing I want to talk about Zelda, I want to talk about more than Zelda, is Prey, though. Like, I kept wanting to bring up Prey when we were talking to Steven, just because there are things in Prey that remind me, that are similar to Zelda, or that make me think about Zelda.
Uh-huh.
So if we're going to change the subject to one thing, it should probably be Prey.
Yeah, let's talk about Prey. So you and I have both been playing it. We are not going to spoil this game, unlike Zelda, so we should talk about this in vague ways. We can talk about specifics, but not like story spoilers or anything like that. We're both really enjoying Prey. I was actually surprised to see how many people aren't enjoying it or found it mediocre.
Yeah, man. I also have been sort of surprised by that. I've played like 20 hours now. I'm just really like, and I really like it.
But I will say, as I wrote in the piece that I published earlier this week, I feel like rushing through the game or playing in long marathon sessions really hurts your enjoyment of it.
Yeah.
I found that because it's so tough and scary and surreal and weird and exploration heavy, I like to play in shorter sessions, like a couple hours at most.
Yeah, I've been playing pretty much every night, you know, for the last, since it came out on Friday, I guess. And I do find there are times where I sort of am just like, okay, it's like 10:30 at night, I could keep playing, but I'm at a point at which I want to stop and just come back to it tomorrow. I also think, you know, you were talking about the game is challenging, which it is challenging. I appreciate the challenge even on mm-hmm. normal difficulty. But it's also challenging to just, it's a really kind of complicated, hard to parse and follow game. And I don't think that's necessarily like all a good thing. Like, I think that the story is just pretty messy and the characters and the cast are pretty messy and it's hard to keep track of what's going on. But it's definitely easier if you take your time and really sort of, you know, read everything and you kind of see like both, you'll find both computers that had the two sides of an email exchange. And by the time you see it the second time, you're like, oh, okay, I think I now remember who that person is.
Oh man, that's so funny. That hasn't happened to me.
It does, just because I'm really, and I should say, I mean, I am really, I'm totally doubling down on the no objective markers, just explore, you know, figure things out for yourself. And so I know the whole space station pretty well at this point. And I would say maybe 2/3 of the way through the game. And it's starting to feel that way. I'm still actually kind of lost on a lot of the story stuff. Or on like the cast, they're just, it's hard to keep all the names straight. And I think that's mm-hmm. actually like sort of a failing of the game. I think that you bounce off. It's really hard to find a purchase on these people and the people in the space station, as easy as it is to find a purchase on the space station itself, which I think is an amazing space.
What do you mean by purchase?
Like, it's hard for me to really know who's who and who's talking about what, and to kind of conceive in my head of like the various social groups and like who is friends and who's working together and the various like functions that each of their groups have. Like, I couldn't tell you the name of the security people or the woman who's in charge. Like, I know Danielle Sho is a name that you see a lot and you get to know her as a character. But there are these other names.
Have you noticed that her name is Sho Dan?
Sho Dan, yeah. Well, I saw that you pointed that out, which is good. But, you know, in general, so I feel like it's hard to really orient myself within this crew, which one of the interesting things about the game is the way the crew, everybody's named. And there are no just like, there are no like just splicers, right? I mean, they're kind of anonymous monsters, but a lot of the monsters are people who've turned into monsters. Uh-huh. And there's a security checkpoint computer at every floor. And you can go look, and everyone's wearing a bracelet, and it shows where they are and whether they're alive or not and sort of what's going on, which I think is really cool. I like that about it. It's sort of making each person a real person.
Yeah. Have you found anyone who you can actually like talk to and interact with?
Yeah. Oh, sure. There are people that I saved at one point that I then talked to, and they was sort of had a side quest.
So I found this story, and I'll be vague to avoid spoilers. I found this thing that I will tell a story of that I will be vague about to avoid spoilers. I went to an area, the Arboretum, and I rescued some people.
Hey, the Arboretum.
Arboretum. And then yes. I rescued some people from a monster, and they were unconscious by the time in order to rescue them, I knocked them unconscious.
Yeah, I did that as well.
You did that. But then what happened was it said that I had to come back to talk to them, like, once mm-hmm. they woken up. And then so I went somewhere else, did something else for a little while, came back, and then it just said I failed the mission, and they were just gone.
Oh, really? So I had that, and they had woken up, and I found the person I was supposed to talk to and talked to her. And she gave me something, and she had kind of, they relocated to a different place in the level because they're like, we're going to fall back to this area where it's safe. And they got out of there because there are other points in near that level where you have to do something, or you can do something similar, or things can go super wrong. but, you know, those people do stick around. And there are other people you talk to. There's the guy in the cafeteria, also no spoilers, which is a whole thing. And, you know, you talk to him. And
yeah, like I'm up to that now, actually.
Yeah, I do want to do spoilers with you and with maybe we can have Riley on, who's doing a review, and do that because a lot of this stuff I don't want to spoil things, but there
are.
Well, so
cool, I'm having such a hard time getting past encounters. Like, I will die so often that I just put the controller down in frustration. Like, for a while, mm-hmm. I didn't have a shotgun, so it was just running around with a wrench and my glue gun, and I couldn't do anything. Yeah. But then even when I picked up a shotgun, I find so many of the encounters so difficult. Like, I'm doing the part where you have to, again, without spoiling, you have to play music and monsters come after you. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't think I've done that. No, I don't think I've done that.
Really?
Yeah. Interesting.
Okay. Then I won't talk
about it. That's cool.
Well, but other encounters, I've had to leave so many encounters because I just couldn't take out the monsters they're just too powerful and kill me so quickly that I can't mm-hmm. do anything. And supplies are so limited, and your medkits and psi, hypno, whatever, are just so limited that I just have such a hard time getting past a lot of this stuff.
See, that's interesting. So I've not had that experience, but I think part of that is the way that I'm playing the game. I mean, I'm playing so meticulously. I constantly recycle everything, but I am just loaded up. Like, I have like 89 shotgun rounds and like 130 pistol bullets, and I've got that laser gun that like I never even use, but it just nukes things. And I have, I don't know, like 40 psi hypos, I think. And I've also like juiced up my sort of kinetic psi blast that does a ton of damage. Like, I own
monsters. So do you just not die?
Monsters. No, I definitely die. Like, there are times where I get into fights because you lose your health really fast. Like, if you take a couple hits or if you get into a room and there's monsters on two sides of you, you can get fucked up pretty fast. But no, like, when I only die once. Like, if I die, I then go back and I do it right and I just crush everything.
So I wonder if that's just because first of all, you had the pre-order shotgun from
the
beginning.
No, because like the pre-order shotgun is gold and gross, but I got a shotgun at the exact same time.
But from the beginning, you had shotguns
Yeah, you can get a shotgun very early, just organically.
Okay, so I hadn't done that, so therefore I was using resources all the time, so I wasn't able to stockpile all those med kits and...
I don't think it's as simple as just the shotgun, though. Like, the shotgun is a very helpful weapon, but first off, there are shotguns everywhere in this game. It still amazes me.
I hadn't found any, that's what I'm saying, until I got to the...
Like, even in the Arboretum, there's one just sitting out there. Like, I think by the time you get to the Arboretum, the game is saying to you, here is a shotgun, like, sitting in front of the place where
you walk
out. That's
where I found one, yeah.
Oh, okay. But, I mean, so that's just part of this is just my instincts in these kinds of games. Like, I open, if there's a security room that says security on it, I am opening that room. I'm getting in, like, because I know there's going to be probably a shotgun in there. And like, that's what happens in the beginning, is there's a security room in the first main area you get to. And I was like, okay, I'm going in there because there's definitely a shotgun in there. And I went in there, was a shotgun, and you do like the cool shotgun loading animation.
Maybe you're just better at video games than I am.
I think no, but I do think that maybe, I don't want to compare us, but I do think that I've got a lot of sort of built-in habits with games, specifically games like this. Because I did the same thing in Deus Ex, Mankind Divided, which is a kind of similar, you know, immersive sim game where like you have a limited inventory and, you know, you manage your, you don't have a ton of ammo, but if you manage it well, you can get really overpowered and you're sort of picking your upgrades, and it has some things in common. And like, I do approach those games, I think, in this very meticulous way that generally makes me pretty powerful halfway through, just because I've hoarded so much stuff and been so careful about, you know, what I use to accomplish everything, that I save a lot and I have a lot of backup. Mm.
Well, so to me, the interesting contrast is Dishonored, because Dishonored was the last game by Arkane Austin, the developers of Prey. And in Dishonored, first of all, every mission, it felt like you could just stock up before you started the mission. But also, it felt like you were just constantly overpowered and able to take out everything. And the challenge was figuring out how to take out everything without killing people or without getting caught. And
the specific objective that you wanted to do or something.
Or beating things in a non-violent way or whatever, without killing anybody. And yeah, so for this game, for Prey, the challenge is, at least for me, was conserving resources, because I felt like I was just using them all so quickly. And it's so interesting that your approach is so much different, because I didn't I was being careful. Like, I felt like I was checking a lot of things too and taking my time exploring and stuff.
Right. And I mean, you know, that I think that the difference there is just evidenced by, like, I found like 7 shotguns by the time I got to the Arboretum. Like, there are just there are all these little areas, if especially you don't know where to go next, because I've had objective markers turned off. I never really know where to go.
That's the biggest difference.
And so I'm just like, well, I'm going to totally fully explore this. But then also, even when I know where to go, like, for example, you go to Psychotronics is an area you go to pretty early on. And you get a kind of important item there. That's where you get the thing that lets you do sort of half of your ability unlocks.
Yep.
Or tied to this psi visor, whatever the hell it's
your
called.
Your magic powers.
Your magic powers. Your biotics. Or no, what are they called in Bioshock? Your plasmid powers.
Plasmids, yeah.
You're basically your plasmids. So you get those there, and you can kind of, I mean, it's pretty clear you're supposed to go on and go to Guts from there, which is the like 0G, you know, sort of back corridors, like the crawl spaces of Talos 1. And you're supposed to go there, and it's pretty clear that where the door is. And once you know how to get there, you know how to get there. But I stayed in Psychotronics for another like 3 hours, just going into every possible place I could. And when I thought I'd gone everywhere, I went around again and I kept finding more stuff. Mm-hmm. And as long as you're really finding more stuff and expanding your inventory, then you can be recycling it and crafting more ammo. And so I was constantly doing that. And then eventually you can craft more, you know, neuromods, so you can be like actually getting new upgrades out of it. And I just sort of been doing that so much and backtracking so much.
Have you installed enough Psy to make turrets go after you?
Oh yeah.
Enough Typhon
stuff? They hate me now. Which, whatever, like, turrets suck, so, like, I didn't really care. Just because the powerful Psy powers are very powerful. But, I mean, to give you a sense of how powerful, I mean, there's an enemy in this game that just wrecks your shit. No spoilers, but it turns up and is just designed to be, it's a whole quest unto itself because it's so terrifying. And I just immediately killed it. Like, the first time I fought it, it wasn't an easy fight, but I had enough stuff that it was like I had upgraded my shotgun and I had like this Psy blast and I had a teleport and I was like, all right, I'm gonna fuck this guy up. And I did, just because
you should play on hard or something. I feel like I would enjoy the game less if I was wrecking everything.
I definitely don't feel that way though, so
because,
that's the thing,
because
is like,
for me the creepiness, the scariness of that guy showing up would have been ruined if I could kill him immediately.
Well, but I didn't like just effortlessly kill him. It was like I had to rely on all the things that I'd amassed up to that point and the abilities that I had. And really, like, for me, the satisfaction that I get out of a game like this a lot of times is just in that cataloging and that like meticulousness and like, you know, doing like sort of maximizing my strategy, and it
organizing
feels so
satisfying. Your inventory,
putting
coffee
again,
mugs everywhere, stacking them up, doing the dishes.
Right. Basically, clean, like being a Roomba, being a video game Roomba. That is
there you go.
Like
that's a good title for an article.
Oh man, and There's a thing, Roomba related thing in a second. Let me finish the thought. Is that I get a lot out of that. And I think if I play this game again, I did this in Deus Ex too. I'll probably play on hard. Because the way you describe playing, I bet that's like what a hard playthrough would feel like to me.
Yeah.
Is like not having enough stuff and constantly being stressed out, which is fine. But for my first playthrough, I generally like doing it this way. Roomba thought is...
Wait, hold on. I have a quick question for you, and then we'll do the Roomba thought, and then we'll wrap up, because we got to go soon.
Quick question. I want to talk about Prey forever, though. Go ahead.
Question. Well, next week we'll talk a bunch more about Prey with our special guest.
Oh, that's right.
Hint, hint. Clue. Surprise. did you fix the elevator, the main lift?
I did. I just did, yeah.
Have you used it yet?
No, I fixed it though, and then went back and did other stuff.
I won't say anything else. Tell me when you do, so we can discuss.
Nice. So the Roomba thing is basically there's this one side quest where you have to get into the morgue, and there are a few different ways into the morgue. This is morgue puzzle solution spoilers, I guess, but your objectives log tells you to do this.
Mm-hmm.
There's an operator, which is one of those little robots that like runs a patrol route through psychotronics, and you're supposed to wait. And then eventually allegedly, it'll go open the door to the morgue. And if you follow it, you can like sneak in behind it, which is a super good solution in general to this puzzle. I spent, I swear to God, like 40 minutes or something, or 30 minutes just standing around, like doing other things, waiting for this fucker to go and open the door. And it would not do it. And I couldn't figure out why. I'm not sure whether my game was bugged or what, because I finally went and looked it up. I was like, okay, is this guy actually going to ever go in there? And people said that he did. They're like, oh, he goes in on the 30 minutes and on the hour, something like that. And I had waited past that and it hadn't happened. He would go up to the door and then he just would stop and walk away. And finally, I found another way to get into the morgue. And I gave up on him. I broke the window and I shot the Huntress Bowcaster, Nerf.
That's
thing.
What I did.
I thought
I was going to blow your mind by telling you that I figured that out.
But that's the best. I hated that thing for like the first few hours. I was like, what the hell is this thing for? And then I actually figured out, oh, this is actually really useful in a variety of situations. It's the most useful Nerf gun I can think of.
I was trying to break the window and like pick up trash and throw it into that room because I thought then it would trigger the cleaning bot to go in there and clean.
That's a good thought. Yeah.
Yeah, no. It wouldn't do it for me. And I had actually gotten an email from someone who told me that she was playing and she was like, this is a game-breaking bug because she accidentally killed that robot but while killing phantoms in there. And then she thought she couldn't do the side quest. And then I hadn't gotten there yet. And then when I got there, I told her what I did and she was like, oh, holy shit, I have to go back there. Because I thought this was like some brilliant thing. But it's so funny. It feels like, because that it also did the same thing for me. I was waiting around for it and it just wouldn't open the door.
Yeah, and I wonder what I was reading threads and people were saying, oh, this sucks. Or someone was like, I finally got in with the bowcaster and then I look up and the fucking thing is standing there behind me like it had come in. And
I
it was
will say that people have said there's some game-breaking bugs and like
there
crashes.
There are bugs. And like, so I broke it because fighting phantoms upstairs, I'm pretty sure that broke it. And then I had actually bought the repair, like the second repair upgrade, just so that I could fix it, just to get it to get me in. So I was also on this like Neuromod sunk cost like trip. And I wonder if that maybe caused this, because one time it like went up to the ceiling and then just sat there and wouldn't come down. And that just seemed like a bug. I had to reload a save and then it went back on it. So it could be. Yeah, there's a little jankiness in this game, which
I was trying to hide. I was like, maybe it has to not see me. Like,
you start to get in a way. Well, and it's funny just because it really does remind me of watching a Roomba where you really want the Roomba to just fucking go over in the one corner and it seems to be stuck in the other corner. You're like, what are you doing? Why? Like, what are you? Why? Why is your artificial intelligence telling you to operate this way? And I felt that way watching this stupid operator float around as well. It was pretty funny.
Oh, man. Well, even in space, the Roombas are just pieces of shit.
Yeah, in the year 20, whatever it is. The Roombas are not very advanced still.
All right, I think that's it for today. We will talk about Roombas and Prey more on next week's episode with a very special guest. And I think that is it. Any final Prey thoughts other than it's really cool?
I really like it, and I want to keep playing. I'm very psyched about it. So I think it's
I really like it too. I was really surprised, like I said before, that there were people who didn't like it. I really think it's the type of game where you have to take your time if you're going to play, and you have to be willing to just sink in time because there's so much time to go around with all these games.
And And not just because the game benefits, but also because, as we've, I think, worked out, you will be more powerful and kill more monsters if you go a little slower and
find
more,
also
do
true.
More exploring.
I may restart the game. I'm still thinking about just restarting a new game and just starting from scratch, because I feel like I just fucked myself there.
I bet if
enemies
you started
all
over.
I
bet if you started over and turned off objectives from the beginning, you would have a really good time. Like, I bet you'd find a lot of stuff that you missed and be like,
yeah.
Wow, this is really cool.
Yeah, I think I might do that, because at a certain point in the game, and sorry if this spoils things, but at a certain point in the game, different areas that are older areas get infested with more and more of these giant-ass enemies, and it just gets
the enemies
like a nightmare.
Scale up as you go around.
Yeah, so it becomes a nightmare to get around.
And if you're if you're a guy with a glue gun and 3 shotgun shells, you might not have a good time.
I did find the a special pistol that is
gold. Oh, interesting.
Gold.
I haven't found a special pistol. You're making me tantalized for things that I haven't seen. Music.
Oh,
that,
man.
That
have you not explored the crew quarters?
I did explore crew quarters.
Oh, well, not enough.
I'm going to go back and explore a little bit more, I guess.
Yeah, man. All right, let's end it there. I will see you next week, Kirk.
Yep, see you. Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.